Friends, a very good afternoon and a warm welcome to Westminster Abbey and in particular to this space, Cheyne Gates. This is the room we're sitting in is part of the 14th century abbot's lodgings, which is now the deanery. It is, the Archbishop and Tim and I were just reflecting on what an extraordinary historic space this is. We know that Queen Elizabeth Woodville lived here in 1486. And it was from here that the two young princes were sent to the Tower. The rest, of course, we have to rely on Shakespeare for some sort of intimation of what may or may not have happened. But back to history, we also know that St. Thomas More was imprisoned in these rooms before he was removed to the Tower of London. So this is an interesting space in which to reflect upon questions of dignity. My name is Jamie Hawkey, I'm the Canon Theologian here, and I chair the Westminster Abbey Institute Steering Group. And it's a huge joy to have you here as we begin this second event in our autumn series, which explores dignity and public service. When this programme was conceived, we wanted to explore what dignity means, where it can be found, how it might be enabled in particularly challenging contexts and communities, and indeed rediscovered in contexts where dignity has been lost or denied. We could not have imagined at that point just how poignant this session would be in the context of the Middle East and in what is currently going on in Gaza and Israel. And we're really privileged to have two speakers with us today who bring a lifetime's knowledge of intense work in that region. Archbishop Bashar Warder was consecrated as Bishop of Erbil in 2010, and amongst his wide responsibilities in the region and beyond is very well known as a voice for persecuted Christians throughout the Middle East. Archbishop Warder preached last night at the Eucharist for All Saints Day. You'll be able to hear that sermon again on the Abbey's website, and I encourage you to do so. Tim Livesey is Chief Executive of Embrace the Middle East, a charity that partners with Christians in the region to transform lives and restore the dignity of the most marginalized. You can read more about them in the biographies which are on your chairs. But we're immensely grateful both to Archbishop Warder and to Tim for being with us today. So let's begin thinking together about dignity and hostility. And I'd like to begin by asking the Archbishop to share some initial reflections on the role of dignity in the region.
Thank you, Jim. To start with, as we come from Middle East, also from Middle East, we've heard this revolutionary and remarkable revolution is God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him male and female, he created them. And this really put the whole things in perspective, because from that, during that time, the warriors were dignified, the sons of kings were dignified, certain people were only dignified, and here the Bible comes with another perspective saying, no, everyone has the dignity without mentioning race, gender, qualifications in that sense. And respecting that dignity comes from what we call a holistic approach to that dignity. It comes to their rights to live, to their basic needs, even, and most important, the need to live in a society which respects truth about the human person and about everyone else. Because that image have enabled us to understand who we are, that we are the only creatures capable of relating to each other and capable of also relating to God. And more important, and that's really very important to us, that we have limits. We are free creatures. That's essential, because you cannot talk about good and evil unless you talk about a free human being who's capable of choosing to do good. But most important, that there is a limit on this freedom. And I'm sure everyone knows the story of the apple, which is sometimes meaningless. But just to tell us that you are free, you could do whatever you like. But there is always, remember that you have a limit. There is a limit, that there is something that you cannot cross. Put it simply, you cannot eat from that garden. I mean, because you could do whatever you like in this garden, but just remember there is a limit. Today, when we talk also about Middle East, which have given to the world all of these great ideas and holy thoughts and roads, we could talk, and I'm sure you could follow the news, that Middle East also became, for me, when I reflect back, is like a lab for so much of what we called economical ideologies, business, etc. It's where proxy wars, where is the, what we called a land where you could really fight and finish all of these old stories and new stories of certain political agendas. I mean, you could tell. And when we see the face of our people being humiliated, rejected, ignored, and count as a figure, as a number, in so many of these political deals and greedy economy, and even not saying the truth in the about the human beings in the media, which supposed to be informing everyone about what's happening around the world. I see now the dignity of the person is being rejected, ignored, and humiliated, where we should really reflect back and say, no, if we lose the dignity of the human person, we are going to lose everything, because that's the starting. You cannot talk about solidarity if you don't have respect for the human dignity. You cannot talk about subsidiarity. You cannot talk about common good. You cannot talk about all of these great principles that, as the church and its long history in the human affairs, being experts in human affairs, you cannot talk about all of this unless first you set the foundation, human dignity. We are created in the image of God.
Thank you very much indeed. Tim, share some thoughts with us on dignity in the region.
Well, first of all, says thank you very much, everybody, for coming. And thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure as well as an honour to be sitting alongside Archbishop Warder, who incidentally is one of our partners, Embraces Partners. I was very pleased when I saw that, before I was invited to be here today, I saw that the theme that you'd chosen for this season's reflections, the Institute's reflections, is dignity. Because I think dignity is something that we just don't think about enough, talk about enough, consider enough. And this is a great opportunity to put that right, at least for an hour and a half, and hopefully as we go away with some encouragement that the theme of dignity is of fundamental importance for all of us. I was recently in church, and there was a sermon that the gospel of the day was the cornerstone, not the keystone that was rejected, the cornerstone that was rejected. And the priest giving the homily went to great lengths to explain the significance of the cornerstone. The keystone is also interesting. So the keystone, as you probably know, is the stone at the center of an arch that holds it together. It literally holds it together, so you don't need mortar or cement. So it's pretty important. And without it, things don't look so good. The cornerstone, it was explained to me, is the stone that is put down at the beginning of the building process, so that everything that follows is aligned with that cornerstone, using plumb lines and all the rest of it. So it doesn't hold everything up, but in a very important way, it holds everything together. So the cornerstone I would like to suggest that the cornerstone of the societies that we are trying to build is dignity. It's the cornerstone. Now, I'm going to quote to you, if I may, the very first words of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The first word is whereas, but we'll overlook that. This is the preamble. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. I'm going to read that again. The inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Article 1 of the Declaration, the bit that follows the preamble, again begins as follows. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Now, as you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not a Christian document, it's not a Jewish document, it's not a Muslim document. But nevertheless, it seems to align itself with something that Muslims, Christians, and Jews all believe, as just articulated by the Archbishop. And I'd like to suggest that dignity is, as I say, fundamental to whatever home we try to build together. Just a quick word about myself and Embrace, well, not so much about me. So Embrace, the Middle East, the organization that I work for and Jamie's mentioned, well, we work with around 50 Christian partners in the region. And our mission, I think, if you like, or the mission of our partners who we support was put rather well by one of our partners, who's a Coptic Orthodox bishop in Egypt, when he said, actually, the speaker, it was an event in the speaker's apartments, which Anthony chaired. He said, our calling is to lift people up. And that's what our partners try to do. It's what we try to help them to do, with the help of many people who support us, mostly ordinary Christians who give generously. Just a couple of thoughts. We're going to explore the question, and by the way, I'm very pleased that this is a conversation and not a lecture. I'm sure you are too. What is dignity? Where does it come from? What does it look like? And what does its absence look like? Well, like the Archbishop and probably many of you, I am a Christian, so I can tell you where it comes from. It comes from the Creator, because each of us is, as the Archbishop has said, made in the image and likeness of God. And there are no ifs and buts, and there's no they are, but they're not. We are all made in the image and likeness of God. And that is where our dignity comes from. And it is inalienable, because none of us confers dignity on the other. It's already conferred. It's really important for us to understand that. So we cannot take it away. Or if we try, that is inconscionable. What does it look like? Well, I could give you some examples, very, very briefly, because I'm sure we'll have other opportunities. It looks like a school, a kindergarten primary school that I visited about 3 weeks ago in Sabra. Sabra is a Palestinian camp in Lebanon. Sabra and Shatila were the places where there was a massacre in 1982. Carried out actually by Christian forces, but facilitated by the Israeli military. It's a dark place, incredibly dark in every sense of the word. And in this you step off a dark street and you go into this space of light, not much bigger than this, where you hear children laughing and playing and doing their times table and all the rest of it. You're just literally suffused with light and with a sense of hope and dignity, which is created by hardworking people who are not prepared to accept that just because a child grows up in that kind of environment, that they cannot be given the opportunity to fulfill their talent, their gifts, and to flourish. So it looks like that. It looks like a partner that we support in Israel, in the southern suburbs of Tel Aviv. It's a simple sanctuary where people, essentially people who are on death row because they're shooting up with synthetic drugs. Many of them, if the women among them, having to work as sex workers in order to finance their habit. And this is a place where they can go and they can have a meal and they can have a change of clothes and they can shower. It's not much, and many will not make it, but it is a bit of dignity. And one last example. Dignity was the Haredi Jews that I walked past a few weeks ago in London when I went on that first march, who were, like the rest of us, protesting for peace, for an end to the violence. And they stand there with their incredible outfits. Regent Street, they were on Regent Street. It was extraordinary. They are very dignified, and they're very courageous, and they protest for Palestinian rights. And of course, everybody was thrilled to see them there. They were an honored guest. And that's dignity. And we know what the lack of dignity looks like. We've been given some extraordinary images of what that looks like in recent weeks, so we'll no doubt return to that. We have partners in Gaza. We have partners in the West Bank. We have partners, as I've said, in Israel. But I'll give you another example, if I may, and then I'll come to a close. I think it was yesterday, at the COVID inquiry, the Deputy Cabinet Secretary, no less, and for those who don't know, it's a pretty senior position in government, said that she had identified and been troubled by what she called as, quote, unquote, an absence of humanity in the way that matters were dealt with during the COVID, in the early part particularly of that COVID period. Now, obviously COVID was an incredibly difficult thing for government to have to deal with, but it's an interesting observation, isn't it? An absence of humanity. Dignity and understanding and humanity, because the dignity we're talking about is human dignity, they're so intertwined, is vital for government as much as it's vital for everything else. I'll finish with this, if I may. When we go away, and how do we know whether we're respecting human dignity, our own, and the dignity of the other? Well, I've just got three C's for you, sorry, but this is just to try and be a bit practical about this. The first C is collude. Oh, by the way, in the Ignatian tradition, as some of you will know, one of the key all the spiritual traditions and indeed a lot of philosophical traditions actually encourage us to try to do this, to examine ourselves. And in the Ignatian tradition, there's an exercise that is generally done at the end of the day. I'm afraid I don't do it. It's called the examen, but I know there are some people in this room who do. The examen. And it's where we ask ourselves some questions about the day. And they're really questions about, where did I notice God working in my life, and where did I notice his absence, or indeed my inability to recognize him and his action. So this is always against the backdrop that I am loved. It's not a sort of a, it's not a negative thing, exercise. It's an exercise in order to be, understand even more deeply how loved I am, which of course we hope helps us to love others as well. So question one, let's just imagine it's the end of today. Did I collude at any point in the day to undermine the dignity of another? Question two, did I make choices? What choices did I make to underline or undermine my own dignity and that of another? Collude, choose, and finally, cherish. At what points during today did I cherish human dignity? Thank you.
Thank you, Tim, very much indeed. And thank you for bringing this back, as it were, to the personal. We began by thinking about this inalienable dignity in humanity which is given to us in creation, the Imago Dei tradition, the image and likeness of God, and we thought through this, with Tim's help, through the Ignatian tradition as well, that sense of moderating our own inner lives, our own conscience at the end of the day. We've also talked about human rights and the Universal Declaration, and for a long time I've had a sort of working suspicion that the Christian tradition of the Imago Dei has found its way into secular discourse through the human rights language. Actually, when we talk about the image and likeness of God, human dignity given in creation, and human rights, we're talking about very, very similar concepts, if not the same thing, but in slightly different language. I want to focus a little bit more closely again, though, on the region before we get into broader conversation. And Archbishop, I wonder if you could give us an example or two of where you have seen human dignity flourish in the face of great opposition.
Well, I've seen it during the time of war. I mean, where you would have the maximum evilness there, but at the same time you would see and experience like initiatives that you would never think about it, how people would forget everything because they come to a truth, the truth that we are all human beings. We want all to live, and because the first right is to live in that sense. So I've seen it in 2003 when the bombing was so heavy in Baghdad, how people forgot that they are Muslim, Christian, Sunni, Shia, whatever, and gathered all in one place to protect themselves, even if they know that such gathering might be very dangerous if God forbids anything would happen. But they feel that there is something missing in their lives, that they need each other. They need each other. Just the sense of being together in one place, in one spot, that's really. And we continue seeing that kind of solidarity among the people during time of the war. During time of ISIS, when people fled and left everything behind, and they came to churches, you never ask anyone, who are you, from where you are Christian or Yazidi, Muslim. No, you just see in front of you people in desperate need for first someone to listen to them, someone to open a space, even if it's tiny, but at least they feel protected, and to care about their needs. I'm sure both of you, you were in the Middle East, and speaking about priests and bishops, they are point of reference for everything, even for bumpers, for example, because they come to you in the time of need and asking, okay, where to go in that sense. So yes, in the time of war, where you don't expect that something this what called beautiful gestures would come, still you could sense these kind of initiatives of goodness that comes from people that they are in need. They themselves, they are in need, but they are able and willing to share the little things that they have with others because they believe that it comes to a point that nothing worth just to have the community together. So I would still recall all of these events.
Thank you. It is an extraordinary thing where you see an appreciation of human dignity, the dignity of the other, simply as a natural reflex, isn't it? Almost as a muscle that kicks in. That's a quite an extraordinary human sensation, almost, isn't it? I wonder if you'd be willing to say a bit about the night that, I think it was either just before the fall of Mosul or just after the fall of Mosul, when so many Christians fled Mosul up to Erbil. There was one particular night, I think, after which your diocese suddenly built amazing refugee accommodation, healthcare, and as I understand it, that just sprang out of the local church.
Yeah, it was on the 6th of August, 2014. We were with the parish priest outside Erbil preparing for the first communion for the second day when I received the call from the people at the St. Joseph Cathedral that you have to come as soon as possible because something is happening which is beyond control. So many of these families arrived because some of them were able to pick their cars and bring whatever they come, others with buses. So they fled the Nineveh plain and came to our diocese, and soon all of the churches were opened. They couldn't go to the UN camps because there was a fear inside them. But with them also were a flock of Yazidis from the area which around Nineveh Plain. And all of them, they found in the churches and in this district of Ankawa, which is Christian district, a safe haven, I mean, a safe house for all of them. Within days, 26 camps were established, which includes churches and schools and some of the NGOs. But the work of the whole community, where you find families coming to bring those who are in desperate need. There was a couple who waited 13 years for a child, and just 4 days before that happened, they got three children. So you have families coming and pick them to their homes and gave them a special apartment because they were on the altar of the cathedral for 2 days. And when people heard that story, they immediately come out, compete who would pick them and care for them. As I said, you have these stories of young people going to their work as a doctors and dentists, etc., and coming back to the church until midnight to help with ordinary stuff. The kind of people or young people that I have in my diocese, where at home, the parents would tell me, those are our children, and we know when they want to drink water, they would say, "Mom, I need water." But here we are, we see them cleaning the toilet and doing stuff that never would imagine. It's, again, this flame of goodness that's inside everyone. When they see people are in need, they immediately, be awakened to the fact that every human being should start, yes, he's been loved by God, but he is needed. When this word get to our mind that I am needed, not just needy, because I mean the whole media is today saying something different. The media would tell us you are needy, you need this and you need that. But there are experiences in life where it shows that no, you are needed. And you could do something, and you could do something beautiful and good. Beautiful and good. And that would change the life, I don't know, 200, 300, thousands of people around you But it's your choice, and we could make that choice even in the place where war, violence, sectarian violence, hatred, you could name it, all of this evilness which is there, but this will not conquer the goodness that's there. Why? Because we are creating in the image of God who's good.
Yeah, thank you. 26 camps established very
26
quickly.
Camps were established.
Extraordinary.
Yes.
There's something I think very profound here about when one realizes the dignity of another person, one is not just recognizing their own dignity. There is a sense of recognizing one's own dignity, you know? Not just needy, but needed, you know? Not just needy, but needed. That's a wonderful, wonderful phrase. I mean, obviously, in this extraordinarily moving example, there it is possible to point at very, very direct examples which undermine dignity, which tear apart the image of God in other people, which undermine very basic neighborly behavior. But I wonder, Tim, I mean, you've worked in various dimensions of the political realm, including in the Foreign Office and in the charitable sector. I wonder if you could help us think a bit about the sort of big trends in society which really undermine this sense of the dignity of all that the Archbishop has explained to us as being such a natural response to trauma and disaster. What are the big trends that you can see in our society, in global politics, that really threaten that sense of dignity?
Wow, that's a big question.
Small question.
I think that, I mean, first of all, I'd like to start by saying that, as the Archbishop has said, and it's certainly been my experience, paradoxically, it's when you're furthest from power, and when you're furthest from what looks like obvious agency, that you see some of the most dignified responses coming from people, both people who helping themselves, but also other people facilitating progress. There's something about being in the worst possible situation that does actually bring out the best in us and in each other. And I think that one of the things that, when I talked about the cornerstone and the alignment, I mean, I would say, I'm afraid, that I think we've become very disaligned to these fundamental principles. Whether your conscience and your understanding is informed religiously or from a much more secular perspective, that's why I wanted to quote the UN Declaration of Human Rights, doesn't really matter. The thing is to remain aligned, to remain centered, and not to allow yourself to be pulled or pushed out of place. But I think we do, and I'll give you some examples to answer your question. First of all, I think that political discourse, I mean, it won't come as any surprise to anybody here, political discourse has become so degraded that we are, frankly, in deep trouble. Not least because I used to think, I mean, I was very opposed to the war in Iraq, and I thought a lot about that at the time. And afterwards, I had been in number 10, in fact, up until 2002. Luckily, I was then on secondment at the time of the war. I was able to march against it with my son. But one of the things that I realized at that time is that if you want to know where things are going, just listen to the rhetoric. The words tell you where we're headed next. Now, if you accept that broadly as a principle of political diagnosis, then you ought to be very troubled, because what we're hearing is not great. Who decided that our refugee and asylum policy would be called, I can't even remember what it is. What was it? Hostile environment policy. I mean, even if it is a hostile environment policy, do you have to call it that? How dignified is that? I think that the interplay of politics and parts of our media has been for a long time and is very toxic. So this is a place I would point to. And I think the media must take some responsibility, and the politicians must take some responsibility. And to be quite honest with you, we need a separation of the two. Because if the media is to do its job, which is to hold politicians and people of power to account, they can't be sipping cocktails together and swapping lines, you know, sound bites they're called. That's basically a sound bite, it's clickbait. We have to, you know, that has to stop. It also squeezes out the voices of reasonable people, ordinary people, more moderate politicians. So I would point to that. And I'd also like to suggest, as someone who's come rather late to this bit of the economy, our political economy. Our political economy is made, you know, you asked me a big question, so I'll sort of deal with big blocks. There are three big blocks. There's government, there's the private sector, and then there's that little one over there that we call civil society, which incidentally is us, all of us. And my personal belief at the moment is that we have got into such a pickle over here, all power to those who are trying to sort of make it better in the governmental and political sphere. I had a go for that actually over here is because the discourse and the alignment I was talking about is so diminished, is so out of kilter over here for the moment. I'm looking over here. There's a lot happening over here that can put a lot of that right. And even if it can't put that right, or even that bit right, what it can do is give us agency. It can mean we can make a small difference that matters to our fellow human beings. And so, does that answer your question? And so I'll just finish with that plea. Do not underestimate the importance and the power of the power for change and for progress and for dignity that is this social capital that is tied up in civil society. In all its various manifestations, I tend to include the church in that space as well. And by the way, church leaders should not try to play the games of over here, because then they do us all a disservice. Stick to the people. Stick to the pastoral role. And so let's not underestimate how much good can be done, how much social capital can be both created and invested by, I'm not even going to say good people, by any people, all of us working together.
Thank you very much. Archbishop.
I would say that's 100% right, because what we are seeing is that we've seen over the last three decades is the collapse of the, or at least marginalizing the voice of the civil society, which we know that economy, politics needs civil society to function well. Today we see only economy driving political agendas. And I mean, I come from a region where wars is everywhere, but wars there is a business. It's a big business for so many companies, and that's really very powerful to stress this issue, the importance of having civil societies back again to the scene. We notice, I mean, and here in the West, that the voice of the church is being pushed away due to so many scandals, blah, on the media is playing part of this, but we have to come back to this voice again, because these initiatives come to correct what's going on in the economy and in the politics. And unfortunately, what we've seen in Middle East is all about business and money and trade in that sense. Beside that, we have these great initiatives coming from you, from others who are on the ground trying to help the victims of these politics and this greedy economy that's going there, without having any second thoughts. Just we would like to embrace this the people who are there with love and kindness, and to tell that the West is not evil as you are perceiving, because you could tell the reaction of the people in Middle East towards the West is still a very hostile one in that sense. So yeah, civil society is very, very important voice.
Can I just give an example of where this is very starkly evident at the moment, and that is Lebanon. Without going into all the history of Lebanon, which is a very complicated history, essentially Lebanon, the economy has been in free fall since the end of 2019. So much so that when the World Bank visited, I think in summer of 21, it may have been 22, I think it's 21, they described the situation, the economic situation in Lebanon, as one of the three worst economic crises since the mid-19th century. And you probably didn't know that, because there's not a lot of talk about it, but just to put it into perspective, it's that bad. Secondly, the chances of things getting better is very small. Why? Because the political, there is complete implosion of political institutions and a total disdain for the political class, who are considered to have colluded with big business over decades to create this situation. But the reason I mention it is because the green shoots in this utterly chaotic situation in Lebanon, the green shoots are in the civil society space. Why? Because people have finally understood, and you wouldn't wish this on anybody, but it seems to be what's happening. As I say, I was there 3 weeks ago, visit quite regularly. They're realizing we can't rely on this lot or this lot. But there's no point in moaning and groaning about it. We could do that for it. We have to look after each other. So let's roll our sleeves up. And it's interesting because in a way things have gone full circle, because of course in most societies, including our own, the institutions that provide healthcare and education and so on and so forth, it's not governments that provide those things. It was civil society. It was the church. It was and over time government took it over, and we have public sector, what we call the public sector. But it didn't begin as the public sector. It began as a private sector, but essentially growing out of what we call civil society, and indeed in many societies that's still the case. And in Lebanon it's kind of gone full circle. As an illustration of where hope can be found and progress can be made, and as I say, social capital can be rebuilt and rebuilt.
I just want to ask a couple more questions and then we'll open things up to the floor. I wonder if I could ask you both, how do you see it being possible to amplify the voices of civil society? Because I'm very struck by this description of the three, the political, the economic, the civil society, and that in a sense, civil society has become just a playground for the political and economic. I mean, how do we amplify the voices of civil society so that they impact on policy more fully?
I would say, supporting these initiatives that comes, because we have to distinguish also when it comes to the NGOs between two type of NGOs. One which is related completely on funds that comes from the government, and that's very conditioned, because you have, for example, governments who approached us, funds are available, but there are certain issues that you have to take care of, this and this and this, which we say, no, thank you. This is going to really harm the whole social cohesions, and it will at the end, because we always say to the politicians in Europe and in America, please, when you take a decision or any step, think about the consequences of this in 50 years, not to say in, 5 years, 10 years, but don't make it just a reaction on that. So these type of NGOs, but there are another one, say Embrace Middle East, Church in Need, others who are so many are around them, who would depend on the first finding the truth, meeting the persons face to face and their needs, and being a voice, a different voice that's not being conditioned by any government or funding in that sense. And we've seen, I mean, all of the, for example, tweets that comes from these civil society or NGOs, it's quite remarkable because the truth is there. The report of the persecuted and forgotten for made a big change, and it was always a foundation for further the work. For example, even in America, I would recall what the Knights of Columbus done when they really came in 2015, collect all the evidence about Christians, Yazidis, about the whole, and made it to the White House that it's an act of genocide. So I would always encourage empowering those initiatives, because there you would find a glimpse of truth that you could follow, and they would give you names, pictures, addresses to go and find that what they are telling is the truth.
Thank you. That's extremely helpful. Tim, any thoughts on how to act this question of amplification?
Well, I agree with what the Archbishop said, and I just sort of frame it, you know, in a different way, just so we can, you know, perhaps all rally around it. I think that in one reading, that civil society is the weakest link. It has the least power. It has the least investment. Okay? But in another reading, it's the strongest link. But how do we get from one to the other? Well, Black Lives Matter, Me Too movement, the Arab Spring. It didn't work, but it was a beginning. And I would say the people who marched against Iraq, and I would say the people who are marching for a cessation of hostilities in Israel and Gaza, these are we have to give each other agency. We have to encourage each other to think that we can create change. But only if we're courageous, only if we raise our voice, only if we refuse to be intimidated. I am not intimidated by the Home Secretary suggesting that people like me, people like you, people like your children or your grandchildren or the lady who lives next door to you, because trust me, I don't know how many of you were. It was an incredibly diverse, these marches have been incredibly diverse. This is not hate speech. I mean, we cannot allow ourselves to be characterized in this way, okay? So I think we have to be courageous. We have to raise our voice. It is about empowerment, how you get from weak link to a stronger link, to a real investment in the kind of house that we want to build together. We have to empower each other. We have to, yes. And we have to, you know, we have to assert, if you like, and inhabit our own dignity. That's why I went on the march. For my own dignity, but also for the dignity of those that I was standing in solidarity with, who are people I know, some of whom have lost their lives, okay? So I'm not going to be intimidated off the park. And lastly, I would say this, one thing, I often quote this, because before the 2008 Lambeth Conference, when all the Anglican bishops, bar a few, from around the world, came together in Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who was then the Archbishop of Canterbury, gave a series of retreats or addresses in the days before the proceedings commenced. And I attended all of them. I can remember absolutely nothing about them, except for one phrase. That's, by the way, that's my fault, not his fault. And that one phrase was, he described bishops, and of course that was his audience, he described the role of the bishop, or one aspect of the role of a bishop, to be an unreliable ally. Peter was probably there, actually. And I think what he meant by that is, as a bishop, by the way, read as a human, you must never be co-opted, particularly by power. You can ally with power to do good and to create change, but you must never be co-opted, which is the point that the Archbishop was making about those NGOs that some get into the position, a difficult position, they take the money, they take the shilling, and they've lost their freedom. I'm not saying don't take the shilling, but never take it if it means losing your freedom.
Thank you very much indeed. One of the wonderful things about this conversation, it strikes me, is that we've ranged from the real macro to the really personal in terms of how this stuff maps on our own lives. But just before I ask a final question, Westminster Abbey Institute, of course, founded to nurture moral and spiritual values in public life. And we engage with a lot of civil servants, policymakers, people working around Parliament Square. So my last question really is to telescope back out again to the macro. And I want to ask both of our speakers if they have any reflections before we open up to the floor. What would you want to say to national or international policymakers on this topic of human dignity? How can they make a difference to the preservation of human dignity? How could government policy make a difference to the preservation of human dignity? Tim, do you want to start this time?
Okay, thank you. Well, I think it's a really important question. I really, really do. I imagine we all do, because we can see that something's not quite right. I would really just go back to the cornerstone. And if you like, to the secular expression, which is, I mean, it's as good as any other, the preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and indeed the whole of that declaration. And I would say, I know you lost the script, but here's another one. You can refresh your memory. And I would ask our government and other governments to remind themselves why that declaration, what happened in the run-up to, then during the Second World War, which of course included the Holocaust, and to refresh their memory as to why at that time humanity decided that this was what needed to happen next, okay? Because we've lost our way. And it's not that difficult because we do have a body of humanitarian and international law, including, as it were, protocols about how conflict can be conducted. And I would just ask the government, let's just talk about the British government, please go back to the conventions that you've signed up to. Bring them back to the center of your thinking and your decision making, and take your cue from there. And at the heart of all of that is a desire to protect, promote, defend human dignity. And there was one other thing I wanted to say, which I've now forgotten. Just give me a second. Oh yes, sorry. Very important point, I think, anyway, that's come to the fore in the last few weeks. You cannot, I'm talking to the government now, you cannot outsource your responsibilities to the United Nations and then wash your hands of them. And even worse, you cannot do that and then attack the very people to whom you have outsourced. That is disgraceful. And it's particularly disgraceful if you are a permanent member of the UN Security Council that commissions the UN, or rather the General Assembly, to do all this stuff. So that's another aspect of this. It goes with what I've said previously. We must not cut the UN loose, because at the moment, it's got our conscience inside it.
Thank you, Tim. Archbishop, what would you want to say to policymakers?
Well, for me, it's not enough to read the tweets or follow the media or study economy and politics. It's important also to give some time to read history, because we keep repeating the same mistakes of the past and never learned from old experience, and we are just making it worse.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. Friends, our two speakers are very happy to take questions, and there's time for us to have a conversation. So who would like to kick us off?
Thank you, gentlemen. That was very succinctly put, even though you covered a very broad set of concepts. What struck me, first of all, Archbishop, sir, when you were speaking about all these various people coming together in times of a state of war, was that it was for the greater good. And to me, that is a sort of an overall expression that covers a lot of what we've been speaking about. And then the other thing is, latterly in the discussion, when you asked about that set of three and where was the voice of the people, well, I feel that that should be motivated by the church. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. This is interesting, this sense of populism. We've come to think of populism as somehow wearing a rather difficult meaning from time to time. There's a positive side of populism as well. There's a good populism, which is about people rediscovering inherent dignity and solidarity and so on. Lady of the Rebecca.
Thank you for a really wonderful discussion, which has prompted lots of thoughts in me, and I'm a policymaker. And so I'll just share back too. I thought that was a brilliant question, how we amplify the voices of civil society so it influences policy. I mean, I think never expect that the three buckets of public and private sector and civil society will meld together. They won't. It will be like oil and vinegar, and probably should. And once it emulsifies too much, it's too captured. But I think the voice of civil society is brought in one step at a time, one act at a time, one story at a time, one memory at a time, and then through those disruptive times that you've described. Because I know many others here will probably take away the stories you've told us about those camps emerging so quickly. That school, this is what holds in. And I think the answer to the question how policy can make a difference to human dignity, for me, well, as a bureaucrat, there's a process there, isn't there? And if your process of policy making includes evidence, including history, and if it includes engagement with communities and listening to communities, you'll be able to access what civil society is saying. But it does take acts of leadership and individual courage, because it's civil society carries memories through the generations, through what happened to our parents, our grandparents, their grandparents. And political and big business cycles will always work on a shorter cycle. So we have to carry that torch together.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Hugely helpful.
Thank you very much for a very informative presentation. The history of which you are speaking is, in fact, the history of my family. And I agree completely with the first part of your presentation on dignity being within the individual. I am a bit troubled by the transition to then breaking society into parts, because the issues of othering, exceptionalism, and fragmentation of the reality that each and every one of us, in each and every moment of the day, is participating in all parts of our social society, whether it's political, economic, or civil, they all overlap, and we as individuals bring to those roles the ethics we either believe in and have the courage to uphold or fail so to do.
Thank you very much. Would either of our speakers like to respond to anything we've heard so far?
I would say because we are human, we are also in need of others. In that sense, your gifts is help to me to live a dignified life as it would be for others. So the gifts of each other. So some of us would have a gift towards politics, others economy, but overlapping it, I would say then we will create a cocktail that would not help the whole community. And instead of being boasted about just my gift, how about sharing my gifts, but also being open to be criticized about that. So that kind of harmony of gifts, in a sense, that makes it in that. But I'm not talking about each one from his castle. No, at the end of the day, something has to happen in a harmony of gifts that's being given to us by God to be shared. That's my understanding of that.
Thank you.
I'd just like, if I may, to respond to your reflection in a slightly different way, which is this, and it's partly, I mean, put in mind of this partly because it's my personal experience, but also because I was having a conversation earlier about this. I think that the idea that everything is connected and integrated and that the whole, absolutely. And I think that you know, our humanness is something that we share, all of us, you know, and our religion, or as the Archbishop said to begin with, your religion or your ethnic background, this in one sense is not relevant. In another sense, it is very relevant because of experience and personal experience and communities' experiences. But in one sense, it's not. At one level, it's not. And I just wanted to say that I think in order to try to be to act and to live with as much integrity as we possibly can, each of us individually, we have to find a way, I think, not to split ourselves into parts. There's a part that goes to work, and there's another part that worships on Sunday or Saturday or Friday. And I think we are encouraged to do that, to split ourselves in parts. It's part of the problem of our society. I, as a diplomat, was sort of expected to be a diplomat rather than a Christian. So that bit got left, with my bike as I locked it at the Foreign Office in the morning. And I wasn't really prepared to do that. Well, not out of any high-minded idealism, I might add, just because I didn't really feel I was being myself. But we must be ourselves, and we must be allowed to be ourselves in everything that we do, and allow others to be themselves. So obviously there is a respect and a tolerance, and sometimes you have to hold yourself in. But why should we leave anything at the door?
Thank you. Question here.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Archbishop. So I'm presented with two dilemmas, and the first is, if we're looking for unity across sectors in every dimension you could possibly imagine, where does that leave us in terms of holding people to account? And secondly, I'm a practicing Muslim, and to your point about the role of the church, I'm afraid to say that I'm seeing my communities fall apart. And I do wonder if there is a role for the church to bring the people of the book together, as our communities are sadly disintegrating before my very eyes.
Thank you. Would anybody like to respond particularly to this question, this extraordinary, devastating question, really, of disintegration and what the role of the church might be as a partner in that?
I would see the role of the church is huge here to help Muslim community, to tell them that we've been through this. For example, I come from Shia and Sunnah environment, so we could help you to say, well, we've been through this, hardship experience, Catholic and Protestant, for example, and please don't go that road. Please don't go that road. We could tell you a lot about this. And please listen to the wisdom of the human beings in the history that tells you that if you go that road, you are going to destroy yourself and destroy the Middle East and destroy the minorities and destroy everything. That's, I think the role of the church here is that the kind of brotherhood, when we feel that we are brothers and sisters. And that's what I keep telling to the imams. And that's when they come and visit me, and always going and visit them to tell them, listen, there is 600 years, history between us. please learn from us. Don't make the same mistakes. I mean, that's what, there is a role of the church here.
Thank you. And I mean, I trust there are good people in the community that are providing that voice for moderation and sense. What I'm exploring is the prospect of bringing the Jewish and the Muslim community together at this time, because that is quite difficult, and we are doing it on an individual level. People are having challenging conversations with neighbours and friends and reaching out, but I think it needs to be much broader scale, and we need to do it quickly.
I want to just stay with this very important theme for a minute. I have seen two other hands, but my colleague Bishop Anthony Ball may have a comment very particularly on this question, I wonder. I saw your hand, Anthony, and then I might say something myself.
I think it's so important for you to have identified that there are individuals struggling with this. I mean, you know, as a Christian, I have Muslim and Jewish friends, and indeed, the Abbey itself has participated in bringing individuals in these communities together to talk about issues. I mean, particularly the what's going on in the Middle East and in Gaza at the moment, and in Israel. That is in a context of absolutely respecting each other's dignity and agency and values and recognizing the struggle that each is dealing with. You've put the very real and proper challenge to how can that be amplified, scaled up to say communities doing this together. And I think that flows into in a sense, the theme of this seminar about hostility and dignity. Dignity is eroded where hostility is directed at communities, because you can do it at a community, whereas individuals is much more complicated. And I think as we, as communities, the leaders have a responsibility. The Archbishop of Canterbury issued a joint statement with a Muslim and a Jewish leader as the kind of demonstrations that Tim was referring to, different sides and different religious communities went into demonstrate. So actually, we can do this together. We as communities are responsible for trying to encourage our communities to respect the dignity of the other, and not to lump everyone together, and because that allows the hostility to build up. Once you start eliminating the dignity of the other and just lumping them together, and everyone is like that, and that's why it is so important to have individuals. And in this context, the church is the majority, so has the heavier responsibility. You know, there are Christian institutions being bombed in Gaza as well. It doesn't mean that we can afford to turn around and issue and start the blame game. We have a responsibility as a majority community to try and promote and use whatever dignity we have to invest it in the other. And that same responsibility rests with majority communities in Iraq or in Israel. And you do see people, individuals, trying to do it. I mean, some of the strongest voices for peace and for Palestinian dignity have come from Jewish community, even those whose families are being held hostage. They're standing up and saying, my mother stood for the dignity, you know, and that's what you've got to do. And I will not allow you to lump us all together and start eroding our dignity. And I think that is where the church is not working hard. I mean, it's working as hard as it can, but it's not yet having the impact it needs to.
Thank you very much. There was a meeting reported in The Guardian a couple of days ago, a report of a meeting here between a group of Jewish and Islamic women. So it's a Jewish and Muslim women together here, and Christian, forgive me, the three great Abrahamic faiths together meeting here privately, but to discuss some of these issues in an important way. That was reported in The Guardian 2 or 3 days ago. Now, time is pressing on, I'm afraid, friends. I have seen two other hands, the gentleman here in the middle and the lady at the back. I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, to keep your questions very short and to ask them back to back. And I will then ask Archbishop Warder to respond, if he likes, to these questions and to sum up, and then ask Tim to do the same. Thank you. If you could keep your questions short, that would be very kind.
I think, and I would ask, if we're not missing the point, in defending what we are when there are so many others, and unless you share your convictions in a simple way, as the Archbishop of Canterbury said, in the power of reconciliation, you have to listen. And as the architect for the King Khalid's Mosque in Riyadh, in memory of King Khalid, I'm proud that as a Christian, I can help. And our differences made no difference.
Thank you very much indeed. And the lady at the back.
Thank you very much, and thank you for a very interesting discussion. By the way, I too am Foreign Office, or many years working on the Middle East. But for the last 20 years or so, I've also worked on the civil society side, and I chair the Iraq Working Group on Freedom of Religion and Belief. I think the big issue, there are two issues here. One is dignity that we're talking about. You cannot have dignity if you have no rights. And in Iraq, the religious minorities have very, very few rights at all. And in fact, we are working at the moment as a working group with Iraq's own roundtable to put through legislation in the Iraq parliament that would give a few rights to those minority groups. But the real issue is not so much hostility everywhere, it's inaction and indifference. We have had meeting after meeting with my own leadership, my own former colleagues and ministers, pointed out issues. We're not asking for money, we're asking for their support in helping to get legislation like this through Parliament, which will help to restore dignity to people. And I think that's the big issue, is indifference and inaction on these issues, which are critical for maintaining dignity.
Thank you very much indeed for that very precise diagnosis. Archbishop, I wonder whether you have any response to anything you've heard from the floor, and if not, if you'd like to sum up for us.
Summing up, I mean, again, back to the first page of the Bible, we are created in the image of God, and when we see the face of people around us, seeing in them the face of God, I think everything will change, because the respect, the adoration, the sacredness is all there. But once we forget this truth, a lot of things would come with that. But seeing the face of God and the face of every brothers and sisters who are around us would make a big change in our life.
Thank you very much. And Tim, any closing remarks?
If I may, just three very briefly. To pick up your point, I think that you used a word which is really very important for us to go away with and to reflect upon. And that word is indifference. And Pope Francis has said that really the great sin of our age is indifference. And I think that we should reflect on that. My second point is that, as the Archbishop says, I mean, it's really, really important for us to remember that our own dignity is entirely bound up with the dignity of the other. You cannot separate them. But we are very tempted to. We're very tempted to think, if I look after myself or my lot, it'll all, that'll be fine. And it's not. It's a fallacy. It's wrong. Actually, it's the opposite that is true. My third point, we must act on behalf of each other. And especially the other, the one who needs that more than any other, and he or she is usually the one who is belittled, who has no power, who is excluded. We dignify, we inhabit our own God-given dignity when we act, particularly if it requires a degree of selflessness or courage, on behalf of the other who we see belittled. It's you know, the curse of our age. If the sin of our age is indifference, the curse of every age is a zero-sum game mentality. What's good for you must be bad for me. No, we have to get over that.
Friends, we've had the most extraordinarily wide-ranging conversation, taking into account highly particular moving examples from Iraq, from Lebanon, from Israel and Palestine. But we've also landed again and again on the launch pad of the human heart. The human heart, which is the organ which recognizes the inalienable dignity of every other human life. And just to draw this extraordinarily rich conversation to a close, I want to draw out a very, almost a throwaway phrase of the Archbishop, which for me has become the leitmotif of this conversation. And that is about how we describe ourselves and the other. Not needy, but needed. Not needy, but needed. To appreciate our own agency and the other's inalienable dignity. Our huge thanks to Archbishop Warder and to Tim Livesey for sharing their wisdom.